suspicious of
you. I know what the problem is, it's actually suspicious.
1 minute to what back in? 1 minute.
Clipping on the ME that did that.
Of fresh lemon juice.
Hot. And we'll,
then fold in
what
your
we'll do
cream.
Is cue Jeff and then eventually mix to the picture store.
And when it's all well mixed, place it into
no
individual dishes.
In between the numbers.
Absolutely, yes, mix straight through.
Counting out of VT, 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3,
and cue Jeff.
2,
so you'll need a fresh
1,
pineapple,
6
ounces of marshmallows, 20 maraschino cherries, count them carefully, won't you?
30 seconds.
Cream, back caster in. Sugar, and lemon juice.
And mix.
What will come out next? It's the southeast weather.
You could have left
the
clock
like
in,
it
doesn't
another cold, dull day again, much like
20
yesterday.
Seconds.
Coming back to 2.
The top temperature, about 4 degrees centigrade, or 39 Fahrenheit.
Counting to what back in? 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt in, go tape.
Here are the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on anonradio.net. We are continuing with A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Now, this is a book which has, in addition to a foreword, 28 chapters. Since 29 is a prime number, we'll say that having covered the first 4 chapters already, we're 1/7 of the way into the book. Now, I didn't mention this last time, but the Bison Frontiers of the Imagination edition, Under the Moons of Mars, binds together A Princess of Mars with its two immediate sequels, The Gods of Mars and The Warlord of Mars. Burroughs actually wrote a number of books in this series with titles such as Synthetic Men of Mars and Thuvia Maid of Mars. It was not as popular as his Tarzan series, but he did publish quite a few of these space travel stories, as well as a couple involving a sort of wrong-way Corrigan of the Spaceways, who sets off from Earth for Mars and somehow lands on Venus instead, not an easy mistake to make, and at least one, The Moon Maid, in which someone sets off for Mars and stops by the Moon as well, the Earth's Moon. And there are others that are set elsewhere in the solar system. Now, those first two sequels, The Gods of Mars and The Warlord of Mars, it's very likely that I will read those also in this format. But the next two that I'm going to do are The Moon Pool by Abraham Merritt, and of course the classic space opera, The Skylark of Space by Edward Elmer Smith, Ph.D., known to most of us, I guess, as Doc Smith. The Skylark was really the first serious novel of interstellar travel, and I do hope that you will find that interesting. Another thing I'm going to do today, as I mentioned before, the lengths of the chapters of this book are somewhat irregular. They range from about 5 minutes to about 15 minutes as recorded, and today's program will include chapters 5 through 9. Chapter 10 just plain wouldn't fit, and so I'm going to include a bit of myself reading another story which is not out of the live-action audiobooks format. This is Citadel of Lost Ships by Leigh Brackett, and my intention is to just stick in a clip of that here and there whenever I need to pad out the time. And I'll keep doing that with other kinds of reading material. Could be little magazine articles that interested me, or nearly anything, but I'm going to start with some nice science fiction by an author who is not really as well known as she should be. If you've heard her name at all, the likelihood is you heard of her as the person who wrote the first draft of the script for The Empire Strikes Back, the second Star Wars movie, before she died quite suddenly and unexpectedly. She was actually a very well-known Hollywood scriptwriter, being, among other things, the unfortunate soul who had to work with Faulkner on The Big Sleep. But she wrote some of the very best of the sort of sword-swinging planetary adventure genre of science fiction, science fantasy, space fantasy. She was also married to Edmund Hamilton, who was another well-known writer of space operas, known for his Captain Future and The Star Kings, among others. Well, enjoy!
Chapter 5. I Elude My Watchdog. Sola stared into the brute's wicked-looking eyes, muttered a word or two of command, pointed to me, and left the chamber. I could not but wonder what this ferocious-looking monstrosity might do when left alone in such close proximity to such a relatively tender morsel of meat, but my fears were groundless, as the beast, after surveying me intently for a moment, crossed the room to the only exit which led to the street, and lay down full length across the threshold. This was my first experience with a Martian watchdog, but it was destined not to be my last, for this fellow guarded me carefully during the time I remained a captive among these green men, twice saving my life, and never voluntarily being away from me for a moment. While Sola was away, I took occasion to examine more minutely the room in which I found myself captive. The mural painting depicted scenes of rare and wonderful beauty, mountains, rivers, lake, ocean, meadow, trees and flowers, winding roadway, sun-kissed gardens, scenes which might have portrayed earthly views but for the different colorings of the vegetation. The work had evidently been wrought by a master hand, so subtle the atmosphere, so perfect the technique. Yet nowhere was there a representation of a living animal, either human or brute, by which I could guess the likeness of these other and perhaps extinct denizens of Mars. While I was allowing my fancy to run riot in wild conjecture on the possible explanation of the strange anomalies which I had so far met with on Mars, Sola returned, bearing both food and drink. These she placed on the floor beside me, and seating herself a short ways off, regarded me intently. The food consisted of about a pound of some solid substance of the consistency of cheese, and almost tasteless, while the liquid was apparently milk from some animal. It was not unpleasant to the taste, though slightly acid, and I learned in a short time to prize it very highly. It came, as I later discovered, not from an animal, as there is only one mammal on Mars, and that one very rare indeed, but from a large plant which grows practically without water, but seems to distill its plentiful supply of milk from the products of the soil, the moisture of the air, and the rays of the sun. A single plant of this species will give 8 or 10 quarts of milk per day. After I had eaten, I was greatly invigorated, but feeling the need of rest, I stretched out upon the silks and was soon asleep. I must have slept several hours, as it was dark when I awoke, and I was very cold. I noticed that someone had thrown a fur over me, but it had become partially dislodged, and in the darkness I could not see to replace it. Suddenly, a hand reached out and pulled the fur over me, shortly after adding another one to my covering. I presumed that my watchful guardian was Sola, nor was I wrong. This girl alone, among all the green Martians with whom I came in contact, disclosed characteristics of sympathy, kindliness, and affection. Her ministrations to my bodily wants were unfailing, and her solicitous care saved me from much suffering and many hardships. As I was to learn, the Martian nights are extremely cold, and as there is practically no twilight or dawn, the changes in temperature are sudden and most uncomfortable, as are the transitions from brilliant daylight to darkness. The nights are either brilliantly illuminated or very dark. For if neither of the two moons of Mars happen to be in the sky, almost total darkness results, since the lack of atmosphere, or rather the very thin atmosphere, fails to diffuse the starlight to any great extent. On the other hand, if both the moons are in the heavens at night, the surface of the ground is brightly illuminated. Both of Mars' moons are vastly nearer her than is our moon to Earth, the nearer moon being but 5,000 miles distant, while the further is but little more than 14,000 miles away against the nearly 250,000 miles which separate us from our moon. The nearer moon of Mars makes a complete revolution around the planet in a little over 7.5 hours, so that she may be seen hurtling through the sky. Oh, pardon me. Hurtling through the sky like some huge meteor 2 or 3 times each night, revealing all her phases during each transit of the heavens. The further moon revolves about Mars in something over 30 and one quarter hours, and with her sister satellite makes a nocturnal Martian scene one of splendid and weird grandeur. And it is well that nature has so graciously and abundantly lighted the Martian night, for the green men of Mars, being a nomadic race without high intellectual development, have but crude means for artificial lighting, depending principally upon torches, a kind of candle, and a peculiar oil lamp which generates a gas and burns without a wick. This last device produces an intensely brilliant, far-reaching white light, but as the natural oil which requires it can only be obtained by mining in one of several widely separated and remote localities, it is seldom used by these creatures whose only thought is for today, and whose hatred for manual labor has kept them in a semi-barbaric state for countless ages. After Sola had replenished my coverings, I again slept, nor did I awaken until daylight. The other occupants of the room, five in number, were all females, and they were still sleeping, piled high with a motley array of silks and furs. Across the threshold lay stretched the sleepless guardian brute, just as I had last seen him on the preceding day. Apparently he had not moved a muscle. His eyes were fairly glued upon me, and I fell to wondering just what might befall me should I endeavor to escape. I have ever been prone to seek adventure, and to investigate an experiment where wiser men would have left well enough alone. It has therefore now occurred to me that the surest way of learning the exact attitude of this beast toward me would be to attempt to leave the room. I felt fairly secure in my belief that I could escape him should he pursue me once I was outside the building, for I had begun to take great pride in my ability as a jumper. Furthermore, I could see from the shortness of his legs that the brute himself was no jumper, and probably no runner. Slowly and carefully, therefore, I gained my feet, only to see that my watcher did the same. Cautiously I advanced toward him, finding that by moving with a shuffling gait, I could retain my balance as well as make reasonably rapid progress. As I neared the brute, he backed cautiously away from me, and when I had reached the open, he moved to one side to let me pass. He then fell in behind me and followed me about 10 paces in my rear as I made my way along the deserted street. Evidently, his mission was to protect me only, I thought, but when we reached the edge of the city, he suddenly sprang before me, uttering strange sounds and baring his ugly and ferocious tusks. Thinking to have some amusement at his expense, I rushed toward him, and when almost upon him, sprang into the air, alighting far beyond him and away from the city. He wheeled instantly and charged me with the most appalling speed I have ever beheld. I thought his short legs a bar to swiftness, but he had been coursing with a greyhound. Had he been coursing with greyhounds, the latter would have appeared as though asleep on a doormat. As I was to learn, this is the fleetest animal on Mars, and owing to its intelligence, loyalty, and ferocity is used in hunting, in war, and as the protector of the Martian men. I quickly saw that I had difficulty escaping the fangs of the beast on a straightaway course, and so I met his charge by doubling in my tracks and leaping over him as he was almost upon me. This maneuver gave me a considerable advantage, and I was able to reach the city quite a bit ahead of him, and as he came tearing after me, I jumped for a window about 30 feet above the ground in the face of one of the buildings overlooking the valley. Grasping the sill, I pulled myself up to a sitting position without looking into the building, and gazed down at the baffled animal below me. My exultation was short-lived, however, for scarcely had I gained a secure seat upon the sill than a huge hand grasped me by the neck from behind and dragged me violently into the room. Here I was thrown upon my back and beheld, standing over me, a colossal ape-like creature, white and hairless except for an enormous shock of bristly hair upon its head. Chapter 6. A Fight That Won Friends. The thing, which more nearly resembled our earthly man than it did the Martians I had seen, held me pinioned to the ground with one huge foot, while it jabbered and gesticulated at some answering creature behind me. The other, which was evidently its mate, soon came toward us, bearing a mighty stone cudgel with which it evidently intended to brain me. The creatures were about 10 or 15 feet tall, standing erect, and had, like the green Martians, an intermediary set of arms or legs midway between their upper and lower limbs. Their eyes were close together and non-protruding. Their ears were high-set, but more laterally located than those of the Martians, while their snouts and teeth were strikingly like those of our African gorilla. Altogether, they were not unlovely when viewed in comparison with the green Martians. The cudgel was swinging in the arc which ended upon my upturned face, when a bolt of myriad-legged horror hurled itself through the doorway full upon the breast of my executioner. With a shriek of fear, the ape which held me leapt through the open window, but its mate closed in a terrible death struggle with my preserver, which was nothing less than my faithful watch-thing. I cannot bring myself to call so hideous a creature a dog. As quickly as possible, I gained my feet, and backing against the wall, I witnessed such a battle as it vouchsafed as is vouchsafed few beings to see. The strength, agility, and blind ferocity of these two creatures is approached by nothing known to earthly man. My beast had an advantage in his first hold, having sunk his mighty fangs into the breast of his adversary, but the great arms and paws of the ape, backed by muscles far transcending those of the Martian men I had seen, had locked the throat of my guardian and slowly were choking out his life, and bending back upon his head and neck upon his body, where I momentarily expected the former to fall limp at the end of a broken neck. In accomplishing this, the ape was tearing away the entire front of its breast, which was held in the vice-like grip of the powerful jaws. Back and forth upon the floor they rolled, neither one emitting a sound of fear or pain. Presently I saw the great eyes of my beast bulging completely from their sockets and blood flowing from its nostrils. That he was weakening perceptibly was evident, but so also was the ape, whose struggles were growing momentarily less. Suddenly I came to myself, and with the strange instinct which seems ever to prompt me to my duty, I seized the cudgel which had fallen to the floor at the commencement of the battle, and swinging it with all the power of my earthly arms, I crushed it full upon the head of the ape, crushing his skull as though it had been an eggshell. Scarcely had the blow descended when I was confounded with a new danger. The ape's mate, recovered from its first shock of terror, had returned to the scene of the encounter by way of the interior of the building. I glimpsed him just before he reached the doorway, and the sight of him, now roaring as he perceived his lifeless fellow stretched upon the floor and frothing at the mouth in the extremity of his rage, filled me, I must confess, with dire forebodings. I am ever willing to stand and fight when the odds are not too overwhelmingly against me. But in this instance, I perceived neither glory nor profit in pitting my relatively puny strength against the iron muscles and brutal ferocity of this enraged denizen of an unknown world. In fact, the only outcome of such an encounter, as far as I might be concerned, seemed to be sudden death. I was standing near the window, and I knew that once in the street I might gain the plaza and safety before the creature could overtake me. At least there was a chance for safety in flight against almost certain death should I remain and fight, however desperately. It is true that I held the cudgel, but what could I do with it against his four great arms? Even should I break one of them with my first blow, for I figured that he would attempt to ward off the cudgel, he could reach out and annihilate me with the others before I could recover for a second attack. In the instant that these thoughts passed through my mind, I had turned to make for the window, but my eyes, alighting on the form of my erstwhile guardian, threw all thoughts of flight to the four winds. He lay gasping upon the floor of the chamber, his great eyes fastened upon me in what seemed a pitiful appeal for protection. I could not withstand that look, nor could I, on second thought, have deserted my rescuer without giving as good an account of myself in his behalf as he had in mine. Without more ado, therefore, I turned to meet the charge of the infuriated bull ape. He was now too close upon me for the cudgel to prove of any effective assistance, so I merely threw it as heavily as I could at his advancing bulk. It struck him just below the knee, eliciting a howl of pain and rage, and so throwing him off his balance that he lunged full upon me with arms wide stretched to ease his fall. Again, as on the preceding day, I had recourse to earthly tactics, and swinging my right fist full upon the point of his chin, I followed it with a smashing left to the pit of his stomach. The effect was marvelous, for as I lightly sidestepped after delivering the second blow, he reeled and fell upon the floor, doubled up with pain and gasping for wind. Leaping over his prostrate body, I seized the cudgel and finished the monster before he could regain his feet. As I delivered the blow, a low laugh rang out behind me, and, turning, I beheld Tars Tarkas, Sola, and three or four warriors standing in the doorway of the chamber. As my eyes met theirs, I was, for the second time, the recipient of their zealously guarded applause. My advance had been noted by Sola on her awakening, and she had quickly informed Tars Tarkas, who had set out immediately with a handful of warriors to search for me. As they had approached the limits of the city, they had witnessed the actions of the bull ape as he bolted into the building, frothing with rage. They had followed immediately behind him, thinking it barely possible that his actions might prove a clue to my whereabouts, and had witnessed my short but decisive battle with him. This encounter, together with my set-to with a Martian warrior on the previous day, and my feats of jumping, placed me upon a high pinnacle in their regard. Evidently devoid of all the finer sentiments of friendship, love, or affection, these people fairly worship physical prowess and bravery. And nothing is too good for the object of their adoration, as long as he maintains his position by repeated examples of his skill, strength, and courage. Sola, who had accompanied the searching party of her own volition, was the only one of the Martians whose face had not been twisted in laughter as I battled for my life. She, on the contrary, was sober with apparent solicitude, and, as soon as I had finished the monster, rushed to me and carefully examined my body for possible wounds or injuries. Satisfying herself that I had come off unscathed, she smiled quietly and, taking my hand, started toward the door of the chamber. Tars Tarkas and the other warriors had And Tars Tarkas and the other warriors had entered and were standing over the now rapidly reviving brute which had saved my life, and whose life I in turn had rescued. They seemed to be deep in argument, and finally one of them addressed me, but remembering my ignorance of his language, turned back to Tars Tarkas, who, with a word and gesture, gave some command to the fellow and turned to follow us from the room. There seemed something menacing in their attitude toward my beast, and I hesitated to leave until I had learned the outcome. It was well I did so, for the warrior drew an evil-looking pistol from its holster and was on the point of putting an end to the creature when I sprang forward and struck up his arm. The bullet, striking the wooden casing of the window, exploded, blowing a hole completely through the wood and masonry. I then knelt down beside the fearsome-looking thing and, raising it to its feet, motioned for it to follow me. The looks of surprise which my actions elicited from the Martians were ludicrous. They could not understand, except in a feeble and childish way, such attributes as gratitude and compassion. The warrior whose gun I had struck up looked inquiringly at Tars Tarkas, but the latter signed that I must be left to my own devices, and so we returned to the plaza with my great beast following us close at heel, and Sola grasping me tightly by the arm. I had at least two friends on Mars, a young woman who watched over me with motherly solicitude, and a dumb brute which, as I later came to know, held in its poor ugly carcass more love, more loyalty, more gratitude than could have been found in the entire 5 million green Martians who rove the deserted cities and dead sea bottoms of Mars. Chapter 7, Child Raising on Mars. Dun dun dun. After a breakfast, which was an exact replica of the meal of the preceding day, and an index of practically every meal which followed while I was with the green men of Mars, Sola escorted me to the plaza, where I found the entire community engaged in watching or helping at the harnessing of huge Macedonian animals to great three-wheeled chariots. There were about 250 of these vehicles, each drawn by a single animal, any one of which from their appearance might easily have drawn the whole wagon train when fully loaded. The chariots themselves were large, commodious, and gorgeously decorated. In each was seated a female Martian, loaded with ornaments of metal, with jewels and silks and furs, and upon the back of each of the beasts which drew the chariots was perched a young Martian driver. Like the animals upon which the warriors were mounted, the heavier draft animals wore neither bit nor bridle, but were guided entirely by telepathic means. This power is wonderfully developed in all Martians, and accounts largely for the simplicity of their language and the relatively few spoken words exchanged even in long conversations. It is the universal language of Mars, through the medium of which the higher and lower animals of this world of paradoxes are able to communicate to a greater or less extent, depending upon the intellectual sphere of the species and the development of the individual. As the cavalcade took up the line of march in single file, Sola dragged me into an empty chariot, and we proceeded with the procession toward the point by which I had entered the city the day before. At the head of the caravan rode some 200 warriors, 5 abreast, and a like number brought up the rear, while 25 or 30 outriders flanked us on either side. Everyone but myself, men, women, and children, were heavily armed, and at the tail of each chariot trotted a Martian hound, my own beast following closely behind ours. In fact, the faithful creature never left me voluntarily during the entire 10 years I spent upon Mars. Our way led out across the little valley before the city, through the hills, and down into the Dead Sea bottom which I had traversed on my journey from the incubator to the plaza. The incubator, as it proved, was the terminal point of our journey this day, and as the entire cavalcade broke into a mad gallop as soon as we reached the level expanse of the sea bottom, we were soon within sight of our goal. On reaching it, the chariots were parked with military precision on the 4 sides of the enclosure, and half a score of warriors, headed by the enormous chieftain, and including Tars Tarkas and several other lesser chiefs, dismounted and advanced toward it. I could see Tars Tarkas explaining something to the principal chieftain, whose name, by the way, was, as nearly as I can translate it into English, Lorquas Ptomal, Jed being his title. I was soon apprised of the subject of their conversation as, calling to Sola, Tars Tarkas signed for her to send me to him. I had by this time mastered the intricacies of walking under Martian conditions, and quickly responding to his command, I advanced to the side of the incubator where the warriors stood. As I reached their side, a glance showed me that all but a very few eggs had hatched, the incubator being fairly alive with the hideous little devils. They ranged in height from 3 to 4 feet, and were moving restlessly about the enclosure as though searching for food. As I came to a halt before him, Tars Tarkas pointed over the incubator and said, "Sack!" I saw that he wanted me to repeat my performance of yesterday for the edification of Lorquasp Tomal, and as I must confess that my prowess gave me no little satisfaction, I responded quickly, leaping entirely over the parked chariots on the far side of the incubator. As I returned, Lorquasp Tomal grunted something at me, and, turning to his warriors, gave a few words of command relative to the incubator. They paid me no further attention, and I was thus permitted to remain close and watch their operations, which consisted in breaking an opening in the wall of the incubator large enough to permit the exit of the young Martians. On the side of this opening, the women and the younger Martians, both male and female, formed two solid walls leading out to the chariots and quite a way into the plain beyond. Between these walls, the lithe Martians, little Martians scampered wild as deer, being permitted to run the full length of the aisle, where they were captured one at a time by the women and older children, the last in the line capturing the first little one to reach the end of the gauntlet, her opposite in the line capturing the second, and so on until all the little fellows had left the enclosure and been appropriated by some youth or female. As the women caught the young, they fell out of line and returned to their respective chariots, while those who fell into the hands of the young men were later turned over to some of the women. I saw that the ceremony, if it could be dignified by such a name, was over, and seeking out Sola, I found her in our chariot, with a hideous little creature held tightly in her arms. The work of rearing young green Martians consists solely in teaching them to talk, and to use the weapons of warfare with which they are loaded down from the very first year of their lives. Coming from eggs in which they have lain for 5 years, the period of incubation, they step forth into the world perfectly developed except in size. Entirely unknown to their mothers, who in turn would have difficulty pointing out the fathers with any degree of accuracy, they are the common children of the community, and their education devolves upon the females who chance to capture them as they leave the incubator.
Mind if I take a peek at the... Oh, this is a reading.
Their foster mothers may not even have had an egg in the incubator, as was the case with Sola, who had not commenced to lay until less than a year before she became the mother of another woman's offspring. But this counts for little among the green Martians, as parental and filial love is as unknown to them as it is common among us. I believe that this horrible system, which has been carried on for ages, is the direct cause of the loss of all the finer feelings and higher humanitarian instincts among these poor creatures. From birth they know no mother or father love, they know not the meaning of the word home. They are taught that they are only suffered to live until they can demonstrate their physique and ferocity, that they are fit to live. Should they prove deformed or defective in any way, they are promptly shot, nor do they see a tear shed for a single one of the many cruel hardships they pass through from earliest infancy. I do not mean that the adult Martians are unnecessarily or intentionally cruel to their young, but theirs is a hard and pitiless struggle for existence upon a dying planet, the natural resources of which have dwindled to a point where the support of each additional life means an added tax upon the community into which it is thrown. By careful selection, they rear only the hardiest specimens of each species, and with almost supernatural foresight, they regulate the birth rate to merely offset the loss by death. Each adult Martian female brings about 13 eggs each year, and those which meet the size, weight, and specific gravity tests are hidden in the recesses of some subterranean vault where the temperature is too low for incubation. Every year, these eggs are carefully examined by a council of 20 chieftains, and all but about 100 of the most perfect are destroyed out of each yearly supply. At the end of 5 years, about 500 almost perfect eggs have been chosen from the thousands brought forth. These are then placed in an almost airtight incubator to be hatched by the sun's rays after a period of another 5 years. The hatching, which we had witnessed today, was a fairly representative event of its kind, all but about 1% of the eggs hatching in 2 days. If the remaining eggs ever hatched, we know nothing of the fate of the little Martians. They were not wanted, as their egg offspring might inherit and transmit the tendency to prolonged incubation, and thus upset the system which is maintained for ages and which permits the adult Martians to figure the proper time for return to the incubators almost to an hour. The incubators are built in remote fastnesses where there is little or no likelihood of their being discovered by the other tribes. The result of such a catastrophe would mean no children in the community for another 5 years. I was later to witness the results of the discovery of an alien incubator. The community of which the green Martians with whom my lot was cast formed a part was composed of about some 30,000 souls. They roamed an enormous tract of arid and semi-arid land between 40 and 80 degrees south latitude, and bounded on the east and west by two large fertile tracts. Their headquarters lay in the southwest corner of this district, near the crossing of two of the so-called Martian canals. as the incubator had been placed in the far north of their own territory in a supposedly uninhabited and unfrequented area, we had before us a tremendous journey concerning which I, of course, knew nothing. After our return to the dead city, I passed several days in comparative idleness. On the day following our return, all the warriors had ridden forth early in the morning, and had not returned until just before darkness fell. As I later learned, they had been to the subterranean vaults in which the eggs were kept, and had transported them to the incubator, which they then walled up for another 5 years, and which in all probability would not be visited again during that period. The vaults which held the eggs until they were ready for the incubator were located many miles south of the incubator, and would be visited yearly by the Council of 20 chieftains. Why they did not arrange to build their vaults and incubators nearer home has always been a mystery to me, and like many other Martian mysteries, unsolved and unsolvable by earthly reasoning and customs. Sola's duties were now doubled, as she was compelled to care for the young Martian as well as for me, but neither one of us required much attention, and as we were both about equally advanced in Martian education, Sola took it upon herself to train us together. Her prize consisted of a male about 4 feet, very strong and physically perfect. Also, he learned quickly, and we had considerable amusement, at least I did, over the keen rivalry we displayed. The Martian language, as I have said, is extremely simple, and in a week I could make all my wants known and understand nearly everything that was said to me. Likewise, under Sola's tutelage, I developed my telepathic powers so that I shortly could sense practically everything that went on around me. What surprised Sola most was that while I could catch telepathic messages easily from others, and often when they were not intended for me, no one could read a jot from my mind under any circumstances. At first this vexed me, but later I was very glad of it, as it gave me an undoubted advantage over the Martians. Chapter 8. A Fair Captive from the Sky. The third day after the incubator ceremony, we set forth toward home. But scarcely had the head of the procession debouched into the open ground before the city than orders were given for an immediate and hasty return. As though trained for years in this particular evolution, the green Martians melted like mist into the spacious doorways of the nearby buildings until, in less than 3 minutes, the entire cavalcade of chariots, mastodons, and mounted warriors was nowhere to be seen. Sola and I had entered a building upon the front of the city, in fact the same one in which I had had my encounter with the apes, and wishing to see what had caused the sudden retreat, I mounted to an upper floor and peered from the window out over the valley and the hills beyond, and there I saw the cause of their suddenly scurrying to cover. A huge craft, long, low, and gray-painted, swung slowly over the crest of the nearest hill. Following it came another, and another, and another, until 20 of them, swinging low above the ground, sailed slowly and majestically toward us. Each carried a strange banner swung from stem to stern above the upper works, and upon the prow of each was painted some odd device that gleamed in the sunlight and showed plainly even at the distance which we were from the vessels. I could see the figures crowding the forward decks and upper works of the aircraft. Whether they had discovered us or simply were looking at the deserted city, I could not say, but in any event, they received a rude reception, for suddenly and without warning, the green Martian warriors fired a terrific volley from the windows of the buildings facing the little valley across which the great ships were so peacefully advancing. Instantly the scene changed as though by magic. The foremost vessel swung broadside toward us, and bringing her guns into play, returned our fire, at the same time moving parallel to our front from a short distance, and then turning back with the evident intention of completing a great circle which would bring her up to position once more opposite our firing line. The other vessels followed in her wake, each one opening upon us as she swung into position. Our own fire never diminished, and I doubt if 25% of our shots went wild. It had never been given me to see such deadly accuracy of aim, and it seemed as though a little figure on one of the craft dropped at the explosion of each bullet, while the banners and upper works dissolved in spurts of flame as the irresistible projectiles of our warriors mowed through them. The fire from the vessels was most ineffectual, owing, as I afterwards learned, to the unexpected suddenness of the first volley, which caught the ship's crew entirely unprepared, and the sighting apparatus of the guns unprotected from the deadly aim of our warriors. It seems that each green warrior has certain objective points for his fire under relatively identical circumstances of warfare. For example, a proportion of them, always the best marksmen, direct their fire entirely upon the wireless finding and sighting apparatus of the big guns of an attacking naval force. Another detail attends to the smaller guns in the same way. Others pick off the gunners, still others the officers, while certain other quotas concentrate their attention upon the other members of the crew, upon the upper works, and upon the steering gear and propellers. 20 minutes after the first volley, the great fleet swung trailing off in the direction from which it had first appeared. Several of the craft were limping perceptibly and seemed but barely under the control of their depleted crews. Their fire had ceased entirely, and all their energies seemed focused upon escape. Our warriors then rushed up to the roofs of the buildings which we occupied and followed the retreating armada with a continuous fusillade of deadly fire. One by one, however, the ships managed to dip below the crests of the outlying hills until only one barely moving craft was in sight. This had received the front brunt of our fire and seemed to be entirely unmanned, as not a moving figure was visible upon her decks. Slowly she swung from her course, circling back toward us in an erratic and pitiful manner. Instantly, the warriors ceased firing, for it was quite apparent that the vessel was entirely helpless, and, far from being in a position to inflict harm upon us, she could not even control herself sufficiently to escape. As she neared the city, the warriors rushed out upon the plain to meet her, but it was evident that she still was too high for them to reach her decks. From my vantage point in the window, I could see the bodies of her crew strewn about, although I could not make out what manner of creatures they might be. Not a sign of life was manifest upon her as she drifted slowly with a light breeze in a southeasterly direction. She was drifting some 50 feet above the ground, followed by all but some 100 of the warriors who had been ordered back to the roofs to cover the possibility of a return of the fleet or of reinforcements. It soon became evident that she would strike the face of the buildings about a mile south of our position, and as I watched the progress of the chase, I saw a number of warriors gallop ahead, dismount, and enter the building she seemed destined to touch. As the craft neared the building, and just before she struck, the Martian warriors swarmed upon her from the windows, and with their great spears eased the shock of the collision, and in a few moments they had thrown out grappling hooks, and the big boat was being hauled to ground by their fellows below. After making her fast, they swarmed the sides and searched the vessel from stem to stern. I could see them examining the dead sailors, evidently for signs of life, and presently a party of them appeared from below, dragging a little figure among them. The creature was considerably less than half as tall as the great green Martians, and from my balcony I could see that it walked erect upon two legs, and surmised that it was some new and strange Martian monstrosity with which I had not yet as yet become acquainted. They removed their prisoner to the ground, and then commenced a systematic rifling of the vessel. This operation required several hours, during which time a number of the chariots were requisitioned to transport the loot, which consisted in arms, ammunition, silks, furs, jewels, strangely carved stone vessels, and a quantity of solid foods and liquids, including many casks of water, the first I had seen since my advent upon Mars. After the last load had been removed, the warriors made lines fast to the craft and lowered her, towed her far out into the valley in a southwesterly direction. A few of them then boarded her and were busily engaged in what appeared, from my distant position, as the emptying of the contents of various carboys upon the dead bodies of the soldiers and over the decks and works of the vessel. Their operation concluded, they hastily clambered over her sides, sliding down the guy ropes to the ground. The last warrior to leave the deck turned and threw something back upon the vessel, waiting an instant to note the outcome of his act. As a faint spurt of flame rose from the point where the missile struck, he swung over the side and was quickly upon the ground. Scarcely had he alighted than the guy ropes were simultaneously released, and the great warship, lightened by the removal of the loot, soared majestically into the air, her decks and upper works a mass of roaring flames. Slowly she drifted to the southeast, rising higher and higher as the flames ate away her wooden parts and diminished the weight upon her. Ascending to the roof of the building, I watched her for hours until finally she was lost in the dim vistas of the distance. The sight was awe-inspiring in the extreme as one contemplated this mighty floating funeral pyre, drifting unguided and unmanned through the lonely wastes of the Martian heavens, a derelict of death and destruction, typifying the life story of those strange and ferocious creatures into whose unfriendly hands fate had carried it. Much depressed, and to me unaccountably so, I slowly descended to the street. The scene I had witnessed seemed to mark the defeat and annihilation of the forces of a kindred people, rather than the routing by our green warriors of a horde of similar, though unfriendly, creatures. I could not fathom the seeming hallucination, nor could I free myself from it, but somewhere in the innermost recesses of my soul I felt a strange yearning toward these unknown foemen, and a mighty hope surged through me that the fleet would return and demand a reckoning from the green warriors who had so ruthlessly and wantonly attacked it. Close at my heel, in his now accustomed place, followed Wula the Hound, and as I emerged upon the street, Sola rushed up to me as though I had been the object of some search on her part. The cavalcade was returning to the plaza, the homeward march having been given up for that day, nor, in fact, was it recommenced for more than a week owing to the fear of a return attack by the aircraft. Lorquas Ptomel was too astute an old warrior to be caught upon the open plains with a caravan of chariots and children, and so we remained at the deserted city until the danger seemed past. As Sola and I entered the plaza, a sight met my eyes which filled my whole being with a great surge of mingled hope, fear, exultation, and depression. And yet most dominant was a subtle sense of relief and happiness, for just as we neared the throng of the Martians, I caught a glimpse of the prisoner from the battlecraft, who was being roughly dragged into a nearby building by a couple of green Martian females. And the sight which met my eyes was that of a slender, girlish figure, similar in every detail to the earthly woman of my past life. She did not see me at first, but just as she was disappearing through the portal of the building which was to be her prison, she turned, and her eyes met mine. Her face was oval and beautiful in the extreme. Her every feature was finely chiseled and exquisite, her eyes large and lustrous, and her head surmounted by a mass of coal-black, waving hair, caught loosely into a strange yet becoming coiffure. Her skin was of a light copper color, against which the crimson glow of her cheeks and the ruby of her beautifully molded lips shone with a strangely enhancing effect. She was as destitute of clothes as the green Martians who accompanied her. Indeed, save for her highly wrought ornaments, she was entirely naked, nor could any apparel have enhanced the beauty of her perfect and symmetrical figure. As her gaze rested on me, her eyes opened wide in astonishment, and she made a little sign with her free hand, a sign which I did not, of course, understand. Just a moment we gazed upon each other, and then the look of hope and renewed courage which had glorified her face as she discovered me faded into one of utter dejection, mingled with loathing and of contempt. I realized I had not answered her signal, and, ignorant as I was of Martian customs, I intuitively felt that she had made an appeal for succor and protection, which my unfortunate ignorance had prevented me from answering. And then she was dragged out of my sight into the depths of the deserted edifice. Chapter 9. I Learn the Language. As I came back to myself, I glanced at Sola, who had witnessed this encounter, and I was surprised to note a strange expression upon her usually expressionless countenance. What her thoughts were, I did not know, for as yet I had learned but little of the Martian tongue, enough only to suffice for my daily needs. As I reached the doorway of our building, a strange surprise awaited me. A warrior approached, bearing the arms, ornaments, and full accoutrements of his kind. These he presented to me with a few unintelligible words, and a bearing at once respectful and menacing. Later, Sola, with the aid of several of the other women, remodeled the trappings to fit my lesser proportions, and after they completed the work, I went about garbed in all the panoply of war. From then on, Sola instructed me in the mysteries of the various weapons, and with the Martian young I spent several hours each day practicing upon the plaza. I was not yet proficient with all the weapons, but my great familiarity with similar earthly weapons made me an unusually apt pupil, and I progressed in a very satisfactory manner. The training of myself and the young Martians was conducted solely by the women, who not only attend to the education of the young in the arts of individual defense and offense, but are also the artisans who produce every manufactured article wrought by the green Martians. They make the powder, the cartridges, the firearms. In fact, everything of value is produced by the females. In time of actual warfare, they form a part of the reserves, and when the necessity arises, fight with even greater intelligence and ferocity than the men. The men are trained in the higher branches of the art of war, in strategy and the maneuvering of large bodies of troops. They make the laws as they are needed, a new law for each emergency. They are unfettered by precedent in the administration of justice. Customs have been handed down by ages of repetition, but the punishment for ignoring a custom is a matter for the individual treatment by a jury of the culprit's peers, and I may say that the justice seldom misses fire, but seems rather to rule in inverse ratio to the ascendancy of law. In one respect, at least, the Martians are a happy people. They have no lawyers. I did not see the prisoner again for several days subsequent to our first encounter, and then only to catch a fleeting glimpse of her as she was being conducted to the great audience chamber where I had had my first meeting with Lorquas Ptomel. I could not but note the unnecessary harshness and brutality with which her guards treated her, so different from the almost maternal kindliness which Sola manifested toward me, and the respectful attitude of the few green Martians who took the trouble to notice me at all. I had observed on two occasions when I had seen her that the prisoner exchanged words with her guards, and this convinced me that they spoke, or at least could make themselves understood, by a common language. With this added incentive, I nearly drove Sola distracted by my importunities to hasten on my education, and within a few more days I had mastered the Martian tongue sufficiently well to enable me to carry on a passable conversation and to fully understand practically all that I heard. At this time, our sleeping quarters were occupied by three or four females and a couple of the recently hatched young, besides Sola and her youthful ward, myself, and Woola the Hound. After they had retired for the night, it was customary for the adults to carry on a desultory conversation for a short time before lapsing into sleep, and now that I could understand their language, I was always a keen listener, although I never proffered any remarks myself. On the night following the prisoner's visit to the audience chamber, the conversation finally fell upon this subject, and I was all ears on the instant. I had feared to question Sola relative to the beautiful captive, as I could not but recall the strange expression I had noted upon her face after my first encounter with the prisoner. That it denoted jealousy I could not say, and yet, judging all things by mundane standards as I still did, I felt it safer to affect indifference in the matter until I learned more surely Sola's attitude toward the object of my solicitude. Sarkoja, one of the older women who shared our domicile, had been present at the audience as one of the captive's guards, and it was toward her the questioners turned. "When," asked one of the women, "will we enjoy the death throes of the Red One, or does Lorquas Ptomel, Jed, intend holding her for ransom? They have decided to carry her back with us to Thark, and exhibit her last agonies at the great games before Talhajus," replied Sarkoja. "What will be the manner of her going out?" inquired Sola. "She is very small and beautiful. I had hoped that they would hold her for ransom." Sarkoja and the other women grunted angrily at this evidence of weakness on the part of Sola. "It is sad, Sola, that you were not born a million years ago," snapped Sarkoja, "when all the hollows of the land were filled with water, and the people were as soft as the stuff they sailed upon. In our day we have progressed to a point where such sentiments mark weakness and atavism. It will not be well for you to permit Tars Tarkas to learn that you hold such degenerate sentiments, as I doubt that he would care to entrust you with the grave responsibilities of maternity." "I see nothing wrong with my expression of interest in this red woman," retorted Sola. "She has never harmed us, nor would she, should we have fallen into her hands. It is only the men of her kind who war upon us, and I have ever thought that their attitude toward us is but the reflection of ours toward them. They live at peace with all their fellows, except when duty calls them to make war, while we are at peace with none, forever warring among our own kind as well as upon the red men, and even in our own communities the individuals fight amongst themselves. Oh, it is one continual awful period of bloodshed from the time we break the shell until we gladly embrace the bosom of the River of Mystery, the dark and ancient Iss which carries us to an unknown, but at least no more frightful and terrible existence. Fortunate indeed is he who meets an end and an early death. Say what you please to Tars Tarkas, he can mete out no worse fate to me than a continuation of the horrible existence we are forced to lead in this life." This wild outbreak on the part of Sola so greatly surprised and shocked the other women that after a few words of general reprimand they all lapsed into silence and were soon asleep. One thing the episode has accomplished was to assure me of Sola's friendliness toward the poor girl, and also to convince me that I had been extremely fortunate in falling into her hands rather than those of some of the other females. I knew that she was fond of me, and now that I had discovered that she hated cruelty and barbarity, I was confident that I could depend upon her to aid me and the girl captive to escape, provided, of course, that such a thing was within the range of possibilities. I did not even know that there were any better conditions to escape to, but I was more than willing to take my chances among people fashioned after my own mold, rather than to remain longer among the hideous and bloodthirsty green men of Mars. But where to go and how was as much of a puzzle to me as the age-old search for the spring of eternal life has been to earthly men since the beginning of time. I decided that at the first opportunity I would take Sola into my confidence and openly ask her to aid me, and with this resolution strong upon me, I turned upon among my silks and furs and slept the dreamless and refreshing sleep of Mars.
Citadel of Lost Ships by Leigh Brackett. There's an editor's preface from Robert Hoskins, who edited the collection Swords Against Tomorrow, in which this story appears. He says, "Leigh Brackett has long been lost to science fiction, but she left behind her a legacy of fantastic worlds of strange and wondrous adventures. Her Venus and her Mars bear no relation to the prosaic, overhot lump and dust-shrouded cold ball that space probes are now searching with the camera eye. But what of it? She is like Edgar Rice Burroughs. The magic of her worlds brings them to strong and vibrant life. And who is to say that, somewhere in the universe, there is not a Venus and a Mars as she has so lovingly described?" Citadel of Lost Ships, Part 1. Roy Campbell woke painfully. His body made a blind, instinctive lunge for the control panel, and it was only when his hands struck the smooth, hard mud of the wall that he realized he wasn't in his ship any longer, and that the guard wasn't chasing him, their guns hammering death. He leaned against the wall, the perspiration thick on his heavy chest, his eyes wide in remembering. He could feel again, as though the running fight were still happening, the bucking of his sleek ship beneath the calm control of his hands. He could remember the pencil rays lashing through the night, searching for him, seeking his life. He could recall the tiny prayer that lingered in his memory as he fought so skillfully, so dangerously, to evade the relentless pursuer. Then there was a hazy period, when a blasting cannon had twisted his ship like a wind-tossed leaf, and his head had smashed cruelly against the control panel. And then the slinking minutes when he had raced for safety, and then the sudden hours when sleep was the only thing in the universe that he craved. He sank back on the hide-frame cot with something between a laugh and a curse. He was sweating, and his wiry body twitched. He found a cigarette, lit it on the second try, and sat still, listening to his heartbeats slow down. He began to wonder, then, what had wakened him. It was night, the deep indigo night of Venus. Beyond the open hut door, Campbell could see the liha trees, swaying a little in the hot, slow breeze. It seemed as though the whole night swayed, like a dark blue veil. For a long time he didn't hear anything but the far-off screaming of some swamp beast on the kill. Then, sharp and cruel against the blue silence, a drum began to beat. It made Campbell's heart jerk. The sound wasn't loud, but it had a tight, hard quality of savagery, something as primal as the swamp and as alien, no matter how long a man lived with it. The drumming stopped. The second, perhaps the third, ritual prelude. The first must have wakened him. Campbell stared with narrow, dark eyes at the doorway. He'd been with the Kralans only 2 days this time, and he'd slept most of that. Now he realized that in spite of his exhaustion, he'd sensed something wrong in the village. Something was wrong, very wrong, when the drum beat that way in the sticky night. He pulled on his short black boots and went out of the hut. No one moved in the village. Thatch rustled softly in the slow wind, and that was the only sign of life. Campbell turned into a path under the whispering liha trees. He wore nothing but the tight black pants of his space garb, and the hot wind lay on his skin like soft hands. He filled his lungs with it. It smelled of warm, still water, and green growing things, and freedom. Above all, freedom. This was one place where a man could still stand on his legs and feel human. The drumming started again, like a man's angry heart beating out of the indigo night. This time, it didn't stop. Campbell shivered. The trees parted presently, showing a round, dark hummock. It was lit by the hot flare of burning liha pods. Sweet, oily smoke curled up into the branches. There was sullen glint of water through the trees, but there were closer glints, brighter, fiercer, more deadly. The glinting eyes of men, silent men, standing in a circle around the hummock. There was a little man crouched on the mound in the center. His skin had the blue whiteness of skim milk. He wore a kilt of iridescent scales. His face was subtly reptilian, broad across the cheekbones, and pointed below. A crest of brilliant feathers, they weren't really feathers, but that was as close as Campbell could get, started just above his brow ridges and ran clean down his spine to the waist. They were standing erect now, glowing in the firelight. He nursed a drum between his knees. It stopped being just a drum when he touched it. It was his own heart, singing and throbbing with the hate in it. Campbell stopped short of the circle, his nerves, still tight from his near-fatal brush with the guard, stung with little flaring pains. He'd never seen anything like this before. The little man rocked slightly, looking up into the smoke. His eyes were half-closed. The drum was part of him, and part of the indigo night. It was part of the Campbell, beating in his blood. It was the heart of the swamp, sobbing with hate and a towering anger that was as naked and simple as Adam on the morning of creation. Campbell must have made some involuntary motion, because a man standing at the edge of the hummock turned his head and saw him. He was tall and slender, and his crest was pure white, a sign of age. He turned and came to Campbell, looking at him with opalescent eyes. The firelight laid the Earthman's dark face in sharp relief, the lean, hard angles, the high-bridged nose that had been broken and not set straight, the bitter mouth. Campbell said in pure liquid Venusian, "What is it, father?" The Kralan's eyes dropped to the Earthman's naked breast. There was black hair on it, and underneath the hair ran twisting, intricate lines of silver and deep blue, tattooed with exquisite skill. The old man's white crest nodded. Campbell turned and went back down the path. The wind and the liha trees, the hot blue night, beat with the anger and the hate of the little man with the drum. Neither spoke until they were back in the hut. Campbell lit a smoky lamp. The old Kralin drew a long, slow breath. "My almost son," he said, "this is the last time I can give you refuge. When you are able, you must go and return no more." Campbell stared at him. "But, father, why?" The old man spread long, blue-white hands. His voice was heavy. "Because we, the Kralins, shall have ceased to be." Campbell didn't say anything for a minute. He sat down on the hide-frame cot and ran his fingers through his black hair. "Tell me, father," he said quietly, grimly. The Kralin's white crest rippled in the lamplight. "It is not your fight." Campbell got up. "Look, you've saved my neck more times than I can count. You've accepted me as one of your own. I've been happier here than any... Well, skip that. But don't say it isn't my fight." The pale, triangular old face smiled, but the white crest shook. "No. There is really no fight, only death. We are a dying tribe, a mere scrap of old Venus. What matter if we die now or later?" Campbell lit a cigarette with quick, sharp motions. His voice was hard. "Tell me, father, all and quick." Opalescent eyes met his. "It is better not." "I said, tell me." "Very well." The old man sighed. "You would hear, after all. You remember the frontier town of Lieu?" "Remember it?" Campbell's white teeth flashed. "Every dirty stone in it, from the pumping conduits on up. Best place on three planets to fence the hot stuff." He broke off, suddenly embarrassed. The Kralin said gently, "That is your affair, my son. You've been away a long time. Lieu has changed. The Terra Venusian Coalition government has taken it for the administration center of Tahara Province." Campbell's eyes, at mention of the Coalition government, acquired a hot, hard brightness. He said, "Go on." The old man's face was cut from marble, his voice stiff and distant. "There have been men in the swamps. Now word has been sent us. It seems there is coal here, and oil, and certain minerals that men prize. They will drain the swamps for many miles, and work them." Campbell let smoke out of his lungs very slowly. "Yeah? And what becomes of you?" The Kralin turned away and stood framed in the indigo square of the doorway. The distant drum sobbed and shouted. It was hot, and yet the sweat turned cold on Campbell's body. The old man's voice was distant and throbbing and full of anger like the drum. Campbell had to strain to hear it. "They will take us and place us in camps on the great cities, small groups of us, so that we are divided and split. Many people will pay to see us, the strange remnants of old Venus. They will pay for our skills in the curing of Leshen skins and the writing of quaint music and tattooing. We will grow rich." Campbell dropped the cigarette and ground it on the dirt floor. Knotted veins stood out on his forehead, and his face was cruel. The old man whispered, "We will die first."